Hey, good morning. So, last time we covered more ways of getting reliability in file systems. So one notion was that we had this idea of ordering our updates carefully so at least our state wouldn't become too inconsistent. And we had something which was better than that, where we would keep our state from becoming inconsistent by having one operation be the final update. And we do that in a way where the recovery process was also a lot simpler. When we had the careful ordering, if we wanted to figure out that, oh, that block I allocated, I didn't actually make a pointer to, we need to scan the entire file system to figure that out. And here instead we have this small log that we look at whenever we recover from having the file system possibly in a bad state due to losing power or a crash or something like that. And the basic idea was we wrote to the log what we were doing and a message saying that we've committed to doing that operation. And once we've written that message saying we've committed, we're guaranteeing that either things are going to work normally and we'll do the operation, or we'll have some failure happen, but we'll come back up and we'll look at our log and say, oh, I promised to do that, I'm gonna do it now instead, since I might not have done it earlier. We talked about dealing with the problem of sort of automatic backups that we know users, especially in something like a computer science department, might commonly delete files and then go to the system and say, hey, deleted a file, you have backups, right? And file systems can do a solution for this where they just keep lots of versions of the file system. And a very elegant way of doing this is this copy on write idea, that like for doing fork and processes, we only copy the pages that are actually modified. We can only copy the parts of the file and the inodes and the directories that are actually modified. And that way we can keep lots of versions of the file system and not much extra disk space. And have this idea of snapshots where you can look at the file system at prior points in time. And then we started talking about our next topic, which is distributed systems. So we got to talking about two models of communication. So we had a model which I described as the sort of mailbox model, where we just send messages, they're addressed to someone, they get to their mailbox, and they can retrieve them later. And this is sort of the basic way our networks work at a low level, that you can send a message addressed to someone, then some machine in particular, it will get to that machine. That machine will have it in a queue, some sort of buffer, and some combination of hardware and the OS, and then programs on that machine can retrieve it and process it. And on top of that model, we can build possibly more useful models. So this mailbox idea, like it's enough to do everything, it's what we use, but we have this connection model instead, where it's basically a two-way pipe, where we have some setup, and then we get this handle which represents who we're talking to, and we can have a conversation with them. So you can think of this, you make a phone call, you dial a number, you get a connection, and that you have this two-way communication that is managed for you. You don't need to dial for every time you speak a sentence and say who you are again. That's handled for you. And we have this connection idea which handles that for us. And the way it's going to manifest is it's going to look like a pipe, and in fact it's going to be byte-oriented. Okay, so questions about what we covered last time before I move on? For those of you who decided to brave the weather and got here. So, talked about connections in the abstract, and we have sort of two missing pieces. So when I was showing you connections before, I said we have machine A and machine B, and we specify A or B. We need some actual way of specifying machines, and we're going to talk about the ways of doing that. Another problem we're going to have is, well, you know, on any particular machine, there's lots of programs running. How do I specify which of those programs should get the message? How do we decide, you know, given that I might be running multiple things that are using the network, who am I trying to communicate with when I connect? So we'll talk about that too. And these are both issues of what we'll call addressing or naming. So I'm going to first talk about names and addresses. So names are what I'm going to use generically to refer to a logical identifier. And you've seen this distinction before. So we have file names. And file names are a logical identifier. They're something that's designed to make sense to humans, but they don't actually tell you where the file is. To figure out where a file is, we have to do this lookup. We have to read directory entries and know the layout of the disk. And what we're actually using to access the file in an inode-based file system is an inode number along with what disk it's on. And those are identified in some way once we open the file. That's, you know, conceptually the address of the file. That's how to actually get to the file. Now, that's what we'll call an address. So the address is like actually the location. It's the information you need to get to, the data or the machine. Whereas we have a name, which is this logical identifier, which we can sort of set up in a convenient way, but doesn't necessarily tell us how to get there. Usually there's some indirection from going to this name to an address. So with the file system, that's via directories. We have this occur in other places. So we have like a variable in a program. You write counter in your C code. That's not what it's going to end up as when it actually turns into assembly. It's going to be memory addresses or registers. Like that's really where the value is. Yeah, that's another example of this name-address distinction, and the compiler needs to maintain that mapping. You know, and if you were looking at memory or a dump of registers, you'd need to know what that mapping was in order to make sense of it. And when we generate the code, we don't like have a table where we look up the name counter. We use the address because that's how we actually get to the value. And the same concept is going to apply to machines. So we're going to have names, which you've probably seen before, and addresses, which are going to be, I'm calling IPv version something addresses. So IP stands for Internet Protocol. So Internet comes from, this was a protocol for communicating between different networks. So it's InterNetwork, shortened into Internet. And there's a version 4 and a version 6. Both of which are used today, various points. And we have also host names, which are more logical names, things that we can actually remember. And there's some mapping from these host names to 0 or more IPv4 and IPv6 addresses. And these IP addresses are how the network actually knows how to get data somewhere. That the machines and on the network that take a piece of information that goes going to a mailbox and look at the address, they look at that address and they know how to get it from the address. If you give them virginia.edu, they don't know what to do with that. Okay, so questions on the distinction between names and addresses? So let's talk about host names first of all. So host names, are something called the domain name system, which is a database which is on the network. So in order to look up names, we need to know, look up names into addresses. We need to know at least one address, which is the address where we find this database, because we don't have a copy of it. We have to ask another machine for it. And this database is segmented in a way which is suggested by the division of names into these segments with dots. So we have this sort of EDU part, and that means that there's a separate part of this database on different machines that handles all the names under EDU, and there's a separate part of this database on different machines which handles all the names under Virginia.edu. So this is a hierarchy of names which serves to both divide up how this is stored and how we look it up, and also is convenient for humans. And the way this works is I have my machine, and typically you have your internet service providers, whoever you're getting network connectivity from has a DNS server, and usually when you connect to a network, you get sent that address, and that's how you know it. Otherwise, you don't have a first address, you can't get any of the other addresses. And generally what we'll do is we'll say, okay, I want to look up cs.virginia.edu or www.cs.virginia.edu. So I'll ask my ISP's DNS server for that. And my ISP's DNS server, well, it doesn't actually know where that is. You know, Comcast doesn't run UVA, so they're going to go to a well-known place to look up this information, and they're going to start by saying, well, where do I get the information for EDU? So there's a bunch of root DNS servers, which are run by the people affiliated with the International Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. I think it's a corporation. And that will tell my ISP's DNS server where to find the server which handles .edu. And then it will go to the server which handles .edu, which will tell it where to find the one that handles virginia.edu. We'll go to the one that handles virginia.edu, which will tell where to go for the cs.virginia.edu, and so on. Yeah. So the question is, are these subservers? So these are independent servers, and what my ISP's DNS server is getting back is just the address of the next DNS server. So basically it makes a query saying, hey, do you know where www.cs.virginia.edu is? And the answer from the root DNS server is, no, but why don't you ask the EDU people? And you ask the EDU people and they say, no, but why do you ask the Virginia.edu people, and so on. So this is the typical procedure. I note that there's nothing stopping my machine from actually talking to the root DNS server and all these others directly. It just, generally, that's not what we do. So one thing you might say is, well, gosh, this is a lot of work just to look up one name. How, you know, isn't this pretty inefficient? We have lots of back and forth. So there's one big thing we do to make this faster, I guess I should say, is that, you know, the EDU server doesn't change very much. So we've done this lookup. And we can keep around the value for the ISP's DNS server, for what the EDU server is, maybe for what the Virginia.edu server is, and not check again for the new value very often. So this is something DNS does. Along with your response, you get back how long it's valid for. So you can keep around the response and not ask again, where is EDU? You can just know, next time I need an address in EDU, I can go directly to the EDU people instead of talking to the root again. And this is the benefit of, hopefully, of using my ISP's DNS server, is that because it has, you know, it's often looking up EDU addresses, it doesn't have to go to the root all that time, and I can save time in my lookups, which I wouldn't save if I always talk to the root directly when I needed to find a new name. Okay, so questions about this? Yeah.
Were you saying that your machine caches the EDU address or the EDU server caches?
So the question, this is the ISP's DNS server can cache the address. Okay. My machine might also cache some of these addresses, yes, in addition. But in this lookup, I'm not actually ever learning the EDU server's address. So I wouldn't cache that. I would probably cache the final address, the address of www.cs.virginia.edu. Yeah?
If somebody was trying to load down in the hierarchy, changes the server, so the cache is not accurate anymore, when does it get?
So the question is, what happens if, say, the EDU DNS server moves? So this is why I have this careful phrasing once in a while. So you have to check periodically. And the way it actually works is that this response says, check plus 6 hours or something like that. So the responses they get back from the servers actually have this little extra information saying, check again in this amount of time, saying how long they can keep it cached. And that's chosen by whoever's operating the DNS server. So if you like are running virginia.edu and you know you're going to change where cs.virginia.edu is, you can set that time really short to make that not work so badly. So other questions? So this is a very brief, high-level overview of DNS. If you want the full version, take networking, where hopefully they go into more detail than one slide. Two slides. Okay, so that's turning names into addresses. So then we have these addresses. So I'll first talk about IP version 4 addresses and then IP version 6 addresses. So IP version 4 addresses are just 32-bit numbers. They're just written in this 4-number way. This is called a dotted quad form often. It's 4 8-bit values separated by dots. That's all it is. So you can turn it into a single number, and this is in fact basically what happens in the machine. On the network at least. And the way IPv4 addresses work is organizations get blocks of these addresses, which I've abbreviated as IPs, even though that's kind of imprecise, because they're IP addresses, not internet protocols. So for example, UVA has this range of 64K of them. Google has these ranges of well more than 64K. And these are assigned to organizations, and sometimes organizations sub-assign them to other people. Like if you have a connection from someone, they'll give you probably one of these, maybe more if you're paying a lot of money. But that's how they're assigned in that. And as I said, these are the things that are used to actually send those messages on the network. So every message is going to be tagged with an IP address, either IPv4 or IPv6 address. And machines in the network which are connected to multiple networks, which are called routers, are going to look at the messages they have coming in and figure out where to send them based on the address. And the typical way they do that is they have this big table with ranges of addresses saying, which network do I use for each of those? And sometimes with the default, sometimes not. So they have this big table, and they just get everything looking in, they look at the number, which range is it in, and send it on its way. And if you take networking, you can learn about the fabulous process of maintaining this mapping and making it not ridiculously large. Or not too ridiculously large. In practice, so if you're like thinking of within, you know, UVA, this mapping's gonna be pretty small because most cases are gonna be handled by this anything else. That we have addresses in UVA, we send to UVA networks, otherwise we send it to UVA's ISP. If you're thinking of being a big ISP where essentially you don't have a default place to send things, this mapping gets pretty big. I think current sizes are like order 150,000 entries. So that's the basics of IPv4 addresses. Now, when you're looking at IPv4 addresses, There's some addresses which are special, which do not appear in these tables, or hopefully do not appear in these tables for on the internet. So there's two types of special addresses I'm going to talk about. So first is localhost. So localhost is an address, also known as the loopback address, which goes back to the machine you started at. It always refers to your local machine, and it's just a special case that when your OS wants to send information out, if it's sent to this address, it's just going to keep it on its own machine and say it's being sent to myself. So this is like something you can use for communicating between two processes on the same machine. And typically, you only see 127.0.0.1, but actually, the entire range starting with 127 is reserved for this. And you'll occasionally see people use other addresses in that range, but they're all the local machine. There are also ranges of addresses which are private. So these are addresses which are not to be used on the internet and are used on local networks and then somehow hidden from the internet. So you might see these on a local network where usually what happens is that, say, at home, Comcast only gives me one IP because I'm not paying them, for very expensive business service when IPv4 IP. So I use some of these private addresses on my network. This is typically what a home router will do if you have multiple machines behind it. And those are turned into the one address that Comcast gave me outside my network. And this allows me to have more addresses on my network. You'll commonly see this in companies. Some of UVA's networks work this way because somehow 64K addresses isn't enough. And we'll see that. And there's something called network address translation, which we'll talk about in a bit. There's another type of range, which are link local addresses. So this range here, you can look up. So these are addresses which are supposed to be never forwarded by routers. The idea is that they're used for talking to machines you're directly connected to, like on the same wireless network, most notably. And those addresses can be assigned without talking to someone else, because they're only on the local network. Okay. So I mentioned these private addresses that the internet doesn't see it. So because IPv4 addresses are pretty scarce, there's only 2^32 of them, and it turns out that there are a little few more people than that in the world, and everyone wants one, and a lot of people want more than one. So we convert many private addresses into one public address. So this is a mapping we commonly do. So we use private addresses locally on our network, and outside we make them become a single public one, and we have some box which does the complicated translation to make the machines which are using the private address not even realize it's not a real internet address that is available to the other machines. So that means that when they send messages out, they have the wrong return address that's fixed for them, and so on. By this box with all the complicated logic that entails. This is commonly what home networks do, and some ISPs which are short on IP addresses. I'm mentioning this mainly not because I want to test you on it, but because if you look at IP addresses somewhere, you'll probably see one of these, and I want you to know that it's not an address you can contact from elsewhere on the internet, even though the rest of what I'm talking about might suggest that. Okay, so questions about these addresses and network translation, address translation? Okay, so that's IP version 4 addresses. And you see that they're kind of scarce, and this was recognized as a problem in the 90s. And very slowly, over many years, we've been gradually deploying the next version of IP, which is IPv6. You may wonder what happened to IPv5. Not every version was successful. I don't actually know the details. And you might say, well, IPv4 had 4-byte addresses, so IPv6 has 6-byte addresses? No, it has 16-byte addresses. 128 bits. The hope is we'll never run out. And they're written a bit differently. So they're written in hex with 16-bit parts separated by colons, and use strings of zeros. There's large strings of zeros in the middle of the address might be represented by a double colon. So here I have this double colon, which fills in for all these zeros. Also, for each of these 16-bit parts, I don't need to write leading zeros. So for example, this C00 becomes this. And this is, again, equivalent to just a big 128-bit number. And that's how they work. And they're typically given out to users in blocks of 2 to the 80 or 2 to the 64 addresses, something around that order. So, for example, Comcast gives me a block of 2 to the 64 IPv6 addresses. So I can have one for every single machine I have and have many left over. And there are also special IPv6 addresses. Since people don't, so there are more of them. I'm just selecting some. I'm not mentioning private ones because, well, that comes up a whole lot less often with IPv6 because you don't need to do the translation. You aren't low on IPv6 addresses if we're commonly giving everyone 2 to the 64. So most notably, all zeros in a 1 is localhost. So it's the local machine, doesn't go out, and anything starting with FE80 is a link local address, meaning it only works on the local network. It's never forwarded between by routers to other networks. And I'm again mentioning these because especially the link local ones, you might see, say, oh, I have IPv6. Well, you do, but not to contact the internet with that address. Okay, so questions about IPv6 addresses. And IPv6 does have some significant differences from IPv4, but as far as we're concerned, it's just a version of IPv4 with bigger addresses. Okay, so the other problem I mentioned besides naming and addressing machines was that we had multiple services running on a machine, multiple programs. And we want to identify a particular program on the machine of the many which might be running. You know, we don't want to contact the web server when we're trying to SSH into the machine with the web server running on it. You have to distinguish between those two. And the way we're going to do that is with port numbers. You can think of these kind of like PO boxes. PO boxes for our machine. And we'll assign each program one or more of these port numbers. And the convention in all versions of IP is that we have use 16 bits for this. And we've divided up the port number space by convention. There's no requirement to use it this way, in a particular way. So the lower numbers are typically assigned to particular services. So we've just decided that HTTP, when you see in your browser HTTP colon, that uses port 80, unless something else says something else. HTTPS, if you see that in your browser, uses port 443. And SSH uses port 22, unless you specify something else. We've just decided this by convention, and we do this with a whole bunch of the lower port numbers. And we use the higher port numbers basically by convention only on demand. Whenever we need a new port number because we need someone to connect back to us, or we need to connect to someone and we need to provide a return address, we'll use addresses in those range. Some questions about port numbers? Okay, so that's, we're dealing with connections. Now that we have connections, we talk about what do we send over those connections. And these are going to be things we'll call protocols. And the concept of protocols exists without like really connections. And very general idea of it's an agreement on how to communicate. And most of the interesting part, especially from sort of more of an operating systems perspective, talking about distributed systems, is what do these protocols look like? And the protocols have two pieces. So one piece is the syntax. And I'm not going to talk much about that, but you'll have an FTP server assignment, and boy, will you be concerned about the syntax of FTP. But in lecture, it's not such an interesting topic of how many spaces there are in various places and things like that. And also, the semantics of the messages is what the meaning of the messages are, what information is encoded in them, what actions to take when you receive a message. And the protocol encompasses both of these things. So protocols are a concept which exists in the human world. If you think of using a telephone, there's a particular protocol, which are expectations on how we're going to communicate. So you pick up the phone. If you have a landline or are lucky enough to be using someone's landline, you check for a dial tone. If you have a cell phone, you make sure you have bars. You dial, you wait for some ringing, and then the person who picks up says hello. This is just a social agreement we have that if they say hello, they don't just pick up and sit there silently. Yeah. And so on, that's the sort of convention we have. That's a protocol. That's a convention on how we communicate, and the person calling, says who they are typically. Even if you might already know, that's just the social convention, and they talk about what the request we have. And when we're done, we have this convention that, someone says bye, someone else says bye, and then you hang up. So these are all protocol things. This is sort of a social agreement we have. It's not written down formally like we would like to do for protocols that you have to implement in code so you know if they're right. But we have this sort of convention on how we communicate, and protocols in the computer world are the same thing. So it's so we have a connection, what are we gonna send, who's gonna say hello first, how do we make requests, what do I expect back, if I ask to send a file, is the server gonna tell me if I did it or not, and things like that. Okay. And we're going to actually have not just protocols, but we're going to have layers of protocols. So I told you about this mailbox model, and the implementation of that is a protocol, that we have to have a certain way when we're sending a message across the internet of how do we format that message for those routers to know where do I send forward this on to. So that is a protocol. We have a standard way of communicating with the routers. Here's a message for this IP address. Please send it on, even though we're only sending a message on our local network. So you have a convention on how to format those, how to talk to those routers to send messages on. And then we have protocols that are built on top of that. So the simplest example is UDP, which basically just takes IP and adds port numbers. So we just have this convention about how I'm going to add port numbers, and we just add them into the message and do this on top of IP. So the protocol is really simple. It's basically saying we're going to use this other protocol, but the messages we're going to use to send are messages which have a port number and a real message. The most notable protocol is something called TCP. This stands for the Transport Control Protocol. And TCP is built on top of IP, and it adds port numbers, so that's one thing we're doing. So we're taking this mailbox model and just standardizing what letters we're sending to give us ports. We also add handling of errors. So if someone doesn't get a message from me, TCP handles resending that, or trying to. It also handles if we have a lot of data to send. Well, IP has a limit on the message size, TCP will split it up. TCP also handles rate control, which is if I have a lot of data to send and the network's not that fast, sending it at the rate the network can handle rather than overloading it. So those are all things where we have a convention on how to do that. So like for resending messages, this means we need to have a convention on how do I know if the message got there, how much do I resend it, and so on. And then we have protocols which are built on top of one of these. So for example, HTTP, what web browsers use to communicate with web servers, is built on TCP. So we take TCP's implementation of connections, and on top of it, we have a convention for how do I say what file I want, how do I know if I didn't find the file, how do I know if I need to go somewhere else. All that is part of HTTP, is a standard of how do I send the request to the server, how do I format it, and how do I respond if the server, you know, wants to give me an error or something like that. Okay. And there are a whole lot of protocols, thousands. I'll mention some more that you've probably seen. So TLS, sometimes also called SSL. There are some tiny differences. Basically, SSL is the older version. Is like TCP, but it adds to TCP, quote unquote, security, encryption, and authentication. So people on the same network can't read your data. You also have SSH, which you probably use. So that's a protocol built on TCP for remote login. So it has a convention of how do I send usernames, passwords, and so on. And we have even more layering sometimes. So for example, this TLS is built on TCP, and HTTPS is HTTP, but instead of layering on TCP, we layered it on TLS, which is layered on TCP, which is layered on IP. We have these big stacks. And similarly, SCP and SFTP, if you use SCP, SCP is built on top of the SSH protocol. So there's, which is built on TCP and so on. And we'll have an assignment, which should be released probably late tomorrow, not that you'll start it early, for doing the FTP server. I mean, what to do is up there. I hope to have some test programs and the like for some corner cases. And actual skeleton code, but the skeleton code's basically gonna be a make file and a main that does nothing. So you can start without that. So that's what you're gonna be implementing, and what FTP does is transfer files. Okay. So I talked sort of about addressing and protocols in the abstract, and we talked about connections. So next I'm going to talk about, well, I want to implement FTP to pass the assignment at least, and I want to use these connections, and I mentioned that they are like bidirectional pipes, but how do I set them up? So I know I need to give an address and a port number. How do I do that? How does it work? So let's talk about sockets in more detail. So I mentioned sockets are sort of these bidirectional pipes. So they're the positive abstraction of any sort of network IO queue. Because remember, we have this queue of messages coming in. There's like a pipe has a buffer of stuff. That's the abstraction. They're a file descriptor. And we mentioned we can have connected sockets. So there are other types of sockets. We'll see one later on. But connected sockets represent a connection and act like a bidirectional pipe. So you write, then you can read, and it works in bytes for TCP. You know. So this is byte stream for TCP, which is what we'll be caring about in this course. There are, UDP is also supported this way and works differently in ways that are a pain to implement, so you won't be doing it. So it's a byte stream, just like pipes are. So you can write one byte at a time and read more than one, and so on. And once you have these connected sockets, it's like using a pipe. So here I have an example of, I have a client, I take in a socket FD, which is somehow already set up. So we'll show the code for doing that in a bit. And I can, you know, fill in a send buffer, write that buffer, and you need to handle the case where things fail. So something to note is that since we have a network, you know that networks don't always work correctly. So you should be much more careful than you've probably been about checking whether write and read actually return errors. Because there's lots of reasons that can happen. Like something isn't broken with your program if write sometimes fails because like you lost Wi-Fi. And that's something you need to handle. And same thing with read, like if you only read half the line, that might just mean your network is slow. And you'll need to try again, or maybe an error happened and by next time you read you'll find out the connection was dropped because you lost connectivity. So here I'm checking if I sent the whole thing. There's some food. We'll talk about what you should do in this case in more detail in a bit. Then I read, and I write out what I read. So nice, simple client. I'm missing some details here I'll talk about in a bit. And on the server, I have some sort of already set up chain where I read, and then I write. In sort of the same way and also handle this error case. So note the protocol here, we do have a protocol, might look like we don't. The protocol has a significant choice, and that choice is that the client talks first. And the server sends back what afterwards. Otherwise, it just sends things back. And I'm showing this example also partly because I have linked off the schedule page and the FTP server assignment a fully functional Echo client and server, including code to do the connection setup, which I'll talk about in a bit, that you are welcome to look at in addition to examples online. This isn't a read the documentation and try to make sure you write the correct code when there are examples of how to do it, and that's how most people do it anyways. So we'll give you some. So looks kind of just like using a pipe, except the pipe works in both directions. And generally we'll use write and read directly with sockets, if only to handle the issue of, you want to stop reading when you get to the end of the command and not try to keep reading while the other end might be waiting for you to write back. So a note that when you're looking at other examples for sockets, you might see send or receive. So these are some other functions like receive from, receive message, send to, I believe is one too. These are functions which work like read and write, but have some additional options that we don't care about in this class, but other programs might. So just to note, if you see them, they're nothing magical. And write and read are equivalent to send and receive with options that don't specify anything for the additional arguments. Okay, so this is what we do once we have a connection set up. So what does setting up a connection look like? And this is going to involve an extra socket. So our client is going to create a socket, and to do that, we're going to use the socket call, socket library call. And the server is going to create a socket, but it's not going to be the socket we're going to use for the connection. It's going to be a special kind of socket we'll call a server socket. But for both of these, we're going to call this socket function to create the file descriptor. Not open. Then the server socket, we're going to call listen. And this turns the server socket from an unspecified normal, quote unquote, normal socket to a server socket and says, we want to get connections initiated on this socket. We want to be able to accept connections, not just one connection, but possibly many connections on the socket. And the listen call says, start listening for someone to ask to connect to us. So then later on, the client is going to ask to connect to the server socket using the connect function. And that's going to send a request to our server socket, which is going to allow us to call accept and have it return the actual connection file descriptor, the one that we're using in the code I just showed you before, where we actually write and read. And after we do that, there's a connection between that SOC file descriptor and the other ones, between the client's FD and the server's FD. And we can read and write on that connection. Yes? So the question is, how does the client socket know how to get to the server socket? So you notice I omitted some arguments here. Those arguments are very important for doing precisely that. And that's where we're going to specify that information. Also, I omitted some code here. And that's where we're going to do things like figure out what port number we're choosing for this socket, assuming we care. Which probably we do, so we can know what the client should put in their connect call. Okay. So the way this process works, once we have a connection, that's how things work. So these connections we set up are going to be, once they're set up, identified by what's commonly called a 5-tuple. So we have the protocol, we have the local address of the machine, the local port number, the remote address, and the remote port number. And it might be the case that we never run any code which specifies the port numbers. That's fine. And we never run any code which specifies the addresses. That's fine. It doesn't matter. The machine's going to choose one for us if we don't. So we can explicitly choose port numbers. And for a server, you probably want to do that, but you don't have to. If you don't choose port numbers, you don't choose addresses, the operating system's going to do it for you. It's going to choose something. So if we want to choose the port number, there's this function called bind, and so that's what the server is going to call to choose that. So, and that's what's going to run in here, and based on choosing the port number, we can then choose what we connect to, and I'll show syntax for that. In evidence. So I'm mentioning this because to show one thing. So we can look up all the connections in this sort of way. So you can see here, this is running on my desktop. This is a list of all the connections for my command, which called netstat, which can do that. And you can see that all of them have a local address and a local port number, which are separated by a colon. If with IPv6, the address will be in brackets to make it clear where the port number is. And a remote address. And this is even for things like here, I have an SSH connection to some machine, and that still has a local port number, even though I didn't specify one. And that's what this process here does, is it sets that up. So it sets up the client, when it connects, it chooses a port number, and that ends up being used. And this accept sets up this to be connected to have a particular client in mind and add an entry to this table in the OS. I'm just basically dumping a table that's in the kernel. And each of these corresponds to a socket file descriptor that I'm not listing here because I don't know how to make netstat do that. So our general flow that we're going to see code for in a bit, I'm doing for a client and a server, is that our client is going to create a socket, it's going to connect, and it's going to specify a host name and port for the server. And it's going to get assigned a local host and port in order to make that connection work, because the server needs to have a return address to send to. And the client's going to usually write first. The server could write first too. And then read response and do this in a loop, whatever however our protocol says to do it. Our server is going to be a little more complicated. So here it's going to create a socket. It's going to bind to a host to report. So it's going to call the function called bind. That's why I'm calling it the operation binding to a particular host and port. at least a particular port, so the client knows how to contact the server. It's going to start listening with that listen call. It's going to accept a connection. And then for that connection, it's going to do this loop. And when it's done, both the client and server are going to close it. And the server can go around accepting another connection. Now, with this code here, I have, say, one connection at a time. We'll talk about fixing that later. But for now, we're just doing one connection at a time. So we don't accept a new connection until we finish with the current one. And this is acceptable for your FTP server because, well, we're not adventurous enough to figure out how to test it with a lot of connections, and it's not actually that much extra work to handle extra connections. Okay, so let's talk about doing the connection side on the client first, where it's simpler because we only have one step, which is connecting. We don't have two steps, binding, listening, three steps, binding, listening, and accepting. So this is what the code looks like where I'm specifying everything manually. So here I create a socket, I specify an address family. So AF is address family. So the type of addresses I want to use. And I'm specifying here INET, which is for IP version 4. I specify what kind of socket I want. I say stream, which means I want a byte-oriented, a stream of bytes socket, as opposed to one where I have to send whole messages and read and receive in some other unit. Well, we won't talk about anything but sock stream. So that's what I'll always use. And the protocol, which is going to be TCP. And I need to check for an error, like if I'm out of file descriptors, or if I got these arguments up wrong for sockets. And then I need to connect. And connect takes the file descriptor, an address, and the length of the address. And for this address family for IPv4, the address is specified in this sock outer in struct, where it has a family, which is going to be always IPv4. It has the number and of the address and the port. So there's some weird stuff going on here. So HTNL and HTNS are functions which switch the byte order of a value from, it stands for host to network. And network order is big endian, because back when IP was standardized, big endian machines were more dominant than little endian machines, so that's what the internet uses, at least for the internet protocol. And it turns out that the numbers we store in this outer struct here, by convention, are going to be something we can copy just byte by byte to the network, so they need to be made into big endian. And that's what this function does. And on a big endian machine, it just does nothing. On a little endian machine, like most of our current ones, it actually swaps bytes. And the struct has to be declared somewhere, so the header is net inet in.h, and there's a man page for it, which you can get with man set 7 IP, which I would not expect you to guess, which is why it's on this slide. You would think you could do man sock outer in, no. Okay. So this is what that looks like, or import T is a type def for a 16-bit value, yes?
So that last slide didn't include any of the server sockets, sir?
Yeah, this is only the client side. I'll do the server next, as I said, because it's more complicated. Okay. So there's something similar for IPv6. So with IPv6, we're going to do socket, which is, this is use with AF INET 6 in the 6 passed to socket. So if you pass AF INET 6 to socket, you can use IPv6 addresses instead. And it has, this is the struct. There's some extra weird stuff that you usually just leave as set at 0, like this flow info, which we won't talk about other than to mention that and this scope ID, other than I mentioned that we usually will leave it set to zero, or in fact, we won't. We'll usually use some other function to set this, which I'll show you in a bit. But it's the same idea. So this process is pretty annoying, and I also have an handle looking up names into addresses. So there is, in fact, a utility function for producing values to fill in this struct or this struct for IPv6, which returns something called a struct adder info. And the adder info is something that you look up with this function and you get everything you need to know to make a connection or to make a server socket, as we'll see in a bit. And includes the address family, socket type, and protocol you should pass to the socket command. So it just figures that out for you, figures out whether you want to use IPv4 or IPv6 based on context, which means that you can write the same code and handle both versions, not worry about what your network happens to use. And then it gives you the address and the address length you can just pass to connect. So it gives you all the information, you just forward the data you get right to the library calls. And it's dynamically allocated, so it has stuff that's dynamically allocated, so you need to free it. And there's a special function it provides to do that because there's no destructors in C, and this is the C API, not a C++ API. So the way that code looks like is you have a host name and a port name. The port name or host name can be the name of something or an address in a string form. So I could have also specified a host name of like 128 dot 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 dot, you know, some actual IP address, and I could, and that would have also worked. And I have a hint structure, which is where I give information about what type of setup do I want. The most notable thing in the hints is that you specify the address family, and one possible value is this unspecified value, and that says, hey, I don't care whether I use IP version 4 or version 6, choose for me. You can also explicitly say, I only want version 4 or version 6. And you also have a hint value which specifies the type of socket you want. We're always going to specify a stream socket that is TCP, not something we don't know how to use. Then you call get adder info, you check if it returns an error, and it just fills it all for you. So questions? And this is my recommendation for how to do it. It's the more modern API. You may see examples which use the older API, which uses a function called getHostByName, which is, I think, substantially more annoying to deal with. But you'll see that because this API is relatively new, like the past decade. So questions? And this function has a man page if you ever decide that there's something you don't know how to do with it. So on. So some minor point about this function that we'll usually ignore is that it actually returns a linked list of address information. So there's a next pointer, and this is because sometimes a name corresponds to multiple addresses. So for example, if you look up the IPv4 address for google.com, there are actually like 5 of them. And they all are google.com, and the idea is that you should choose one at random to contact, and that if one doesn't work, you can try another. So if you're doing things properly, you should like try each thing until something works, like this code here does. Probably you will end up not doing that in your code, just because it's simpler, but this is something that getAdderInfo does, because it really is the case that you can have multiple addresses for something. Other cases, something has an IPv4 and IPv6 address, you want to try both in case one doesn't work. Or like if one machine you look up by name has a wired and a wireless connection, you might get the address for both of them. So let's talk, since we looked at the client, let's talk about the server, and I'm going to do the manual setup for the server here. So we have bind, listen, and accept. So when we bind, we need to specify another one of those address structures. And you might say, well, doesn't that mean I have to look up my IP address somehow? The answer is no, and that's good because looking up your IP address is way more complicated than you think it should be. Like, way, way more complicated. So instead here, I'm specifying this special IP address, which stands in for any address. So it's a special IP address. It turns out to be the number 0, 0.0.0.0, which is not a real address, but says, just let me use any of the addresses this machine has. And make, I want to accept connections for all of them, and that's something you can do. Another thing you can do is you could specify the localhost address, which there's a special constant for, and this is what you might do in your FTP server, where we tell you, please don't accept connections from elsewhere for security reasons. And you need to specify a port number. Or you should specify a port number. Then we call bind, we check if it returns an error. An example of an error would be if someone is already using that port number, or if I ask to bind to an IP address that I don't, that the machine doesn't have. Then we call listen. Listen takes a parameter, which is how many connections to allow to be waiting to be accepted. So you have to specify that, unfortunately. And then we call accept to get our connection. Accept takes another argument, or more, probably two arguments. I think it's Look up the man page. Accept takes an argument, which is a way you can retrieve the address of the client that's connecting to you. There's also other ways of doing that I'll talk about later. So questions on this procedure? So I'll show doing this with getOuterInfo in a bit. And getOuterInfo can also give you all this information. Notably, it can give you this filled in already from a name and a port number as a string like you get from the user and so on. So first, first an aside on port numbers. So on Unix machines, there's a rule that if you want to use port number 0 through 1023, you must be root. You must have super user privileges. Administrative privileges. So for testing, you probably don't want to try to use one of those. Just a quick note, because it will come up. So we can also use getOuterInfo, and it works the same as we did for doing connection setup for a client. The only difference is that we have to specify a flags value, which is another thing in the struct, of this addressInfo_passive. Indicate that this is for a listening socket, not for a connecting socket. And that's going to let it know that, oh, I can use that any address value, for example. Also, you can leave hostname as null, and that's how you specify use all possible addresses. That will use that any value or the equivalent of that value for IPv6. And you can also specify port name of null if you really want to. And so then, same procedure works with that. If you were being better about using getOuterInfo, you'd pay attention to if it returned you a linked list of addresses and bind to all of them and somehow listen for connections in all of them. We're not going to have you do that for the FTP server assignment. And it usually doesn't come up in practice. Questions on this? So I mentioned earlier that, you know, I showed you this sort of timeline, which you've seen how to do all the parts of for doing one connection at a time. And there's a simple change we can make to handle multiple connections at a time. And that's after we accept a connection, we can do all the work we're doing for each connection in the server in a separate thread or a separate process. So we can fork. Remember, fork, we keep the socket file descriptor, so it's still there. We need to remember to close things correctly. This is a case for not closing things. The client will be like, why isn't my connection closed? Or we can spawn a thread for it. And that's probably the easiest way of making a server which handles multiple connections. And if we do that, we just, after we accept, we spawn this thread or process and accept again. Questions on this? Okay, so some details that come up when dealing with connections, which are also things which technically could have come up when dealing with pipes. So one is incomplete writes and reads. /reads. Reads are probably the most notable. So write can write less than you request. And this comes up with sockets. So the most notable case is, let's say I'm writing a megabyte of data, and the system successfully sends half of that, and then I unplug my network cable. And then my connection gets dropped. Write's going to return that I wrote half of this, and you need to realize that it didn't write everything you asked for in order to notice that something is wrong. Also, you can put, you can disable blocking with a library call if you want to, in which case write will never wait, which is sometimes useful if you want to use something else. But that means that it can write less than you ask for and will just say, sorry, that's all I wrote, now the buffer's full, try again later. So read can also read less than requested. So notably, if there's an error after reading some data, it's going to read the data, give you that data back, and then you need to ask to read again in order to find out, oh, that client sent me a half megabyte of data and then my connection got dropped. Also, read might read less than requested. If you read and maybe the client's sending you all the data, but you called read before all the data got there, read will give you what's gotten there. Which means that almost always you need to call read in a loop, because like even if we're talking about sending one line, maybe it's the case that like 10 characters of the line get there and you have to call read again to get the next, you know, 10. So this means that you'll typically, when you're dealing with writes, you'll have some code where you call write, you check what was written, and you try again until you get a failure. And you know, in the case where you're not disabling blocking, this is only so you actually reliably find out about errors. Because the case, what will happen if you have blocking enabled, is that the write will complete successfully as long as nothing bad happens, but if something bad happens, you'll get part of your data written, and you want to find out that, oh, what's wrong, and to do that, you call write again, and if it doesn't succeed, you know that that means you'll know what the error is from the error number, and you can print out an error message of, like, connection dropped or whatever happened. And for read, a common pattern I've used, but it's not the only way of doing it, is have a function which like fills a buffer, and then later on I check to see if I can extract a message from this buffer and get it out. And a reason you do this is because, let's say you're looking for lines, I could send, you know, like, this buffer could be like, I could get, you know, /index.html, new line get /foo, there could be two commands in the buffer and you want to be able to handle that, which is why I recommend this kind of style, so you can just take the first command out of the buffer rather than rather than assuming that you're going to read one command at a time, because that's not guaranteed if someone's very eager and decides to send one command without waiting, send the next command without waiting for the response for the first. So you'll end up with code where you look for a new line or the buffer being full, and if so, you take out that line and move the buffer back and see if there's another line, and so on. And this is to deal with the fact that you can read less than a line in one read command, or you can read multiple commands, or parts of multiple commands in one read command. And that's something, a detail you need to deal with. Okay, so questions about these incomplete reads and writes? Okay, so another issue I just like to mention how to do, because it might come up in the FTP server assignment and it might be handy for figuring out what's going on. There are library calls for getting the address of a connection. So I mentioned that there's a local and a remote address. There's a call get sock name, which gets an address, not a name, but has this name from the 80s. That's what we're stuck with, which returns a sock adder in or in 6, and a get pure name, which gets the remote address of a connected socket. If you ever want to print out where am I connected to, what is my local address, and so on. And when you have one of these, printing them out is kind of annoying. So there's this function which looks like the opposite of get adder info called get name info if you want to print them out as a string and have it be nice and readable. And as I mentioned earlier, I have an example Echo client and server posted on the course website, which you can look at, which handles a few other little details that are just annoying little details that are good ideas to do when you're writing socket programs. One of them is avoiding sigpipe. So it turns out that if you try to write to a closed, to a pipe or a socket where the other end is closed, the OS, instead of returning an error from write, by default, it kills your process. Really convenient. So it handles preventing the OS from doing that because it checks the return value of write every time. It doesn't need the OS's help, which is really good for a server, because killing your entire server when you try to write to one client is very annoying. It also sets a reuse adder socket option, because by default, the operating system will reserve a port number after the server shuts down for a few minutes. The idea being that if there's stray connection attempts, we want to not have them go to the wrong place. But that's really annoying for testing, where you shut down your server, want to start it up again on the same port. So it enables that option to allow reusing it. Okay. And one note on dealing with sockets is that so far we've been alternating between reading and writing. This might be known as half duplex, some name people commonly use for this. But sockets are truly bidirectional. You can have the client and server reading and writing, both reading and writing at the same time, and that works. It's a bit tricky to do this well. So the simplest way is you could have one reading thread and one writing thread in the client, in the server, for each connection. Or you can use an event loop, like we talked about earlier, with non-blocking I/O, and select these functions which say, when can I read and write? An example of a case where you might want to do this, if you think of a chat server, like the client always wants to be reading, but sometimes also wants to be writing messages back. So always wants to be reading in case it gets messages from whatever, you know, chat groups it's in, but it wants to write things at random times, and the server always wants to write to the client and also read. And that, for that kind of server, you need to do this sort of thing. For your FTP server, fortunately, it just alternates, so you don't need to worry about this. Okay, so that's what I have for today. So next time, we'll talk a little about protocols and another model of communication besides connections called remote procedure calls.